This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode contains some strong, offensive language.
When truth becomes something that you can have your own truths, then you don't have the ability to have a symmetrical landscape of information.
Sowing distrust in the media system, in the public institutions, it is heavily associated with conspiratorial thinking.
Finally, the moment arrived, the election.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory.
This is Dark Shining Moment, a Ranieri & Co. original podcast looking at how Russia interfered in America's election of 2016, altering history and helping to create the world we live in today. I'm Chris Sapone. Last episode...
I recall the first news report, it was like the 19th, 20th of March, where the DNC said that they had an intrusion. And I thought, that's interesting. It's only a question of whether it's the Chinese or the Russians.
How are you useful to Russia? If you are destabilizing the West, and if you're especially destabilizing the US, you're useful to Russia. If you're an American who's destabilizing your own country, then you're a gold mine.
By summer, it was clear there were overlapping waves of interference on social media aimed at disrupting and discrediting American democracy. Today, there's a false notion that the idea that Donald Trump could somehow be connected to Russia was just plucked out of the air by, say, the Hillary Clinton camp. But during the event, mentions of Russia and Putin were being pushed from the bottom up on social media. A gang of prolific American trolls retweeted content from the St. Petersburg Troll Factory. They also peppered their posts with mentions of Russia and Putin. Here's the account called Ricky Vaughn, 99.
He's saying he wants to go to another level of relations, closer relations with Russia. How can we not welcome that? Trump looked the most presidential. The other idiots want a shooting war with Russia.
At the time, I took screenshots of all of the posts this account made about Russia and Putin. The account holder was later revealed to be a man named Douglas Mackey. He was later convicted and sentenced to 7 months in prison for his role in a conspiracy to interfere with voters' rights. Mackey has appealed the conviction, and at the time of publishing, the case is pending. But that was just one stream of content. There were the hacks, the leaks, the St. Petersburg troll factory, the international networks of trolls, far-right figures abusing journalists, and the alternative media outlets acting as a springboard for conspiracy theory. The combined chaos was taking its toll.
My name is Tom Cochran. I was formerly the deputy coordinator of platforms for the Department of State back during the Obama years.
The U.S. State Department is the government department in charge of foreign affairs. So if a foreign power was waging a concerted propaganda assault against the citizens of the U.S., it mattered to the State Department. A lot was happening by October 2016. And it was happening faster than the U.S. government could respond to.
In terms of disinformation and use of digital and social media technology, the focus really, for the vast majority of our time there, was on counterterrorism. The priority and, frankly, the news cycle was so heavily focused still on ISIS. When you look backwards, it seems like an obvious, of course these tools are going to be used as weapons against the population.
That's not to say the planners in the State Department couldn't see the mounting challenge from Russia.
I remember conversations where we're talking about strategies and what we're going to do. It seemed to be maybe a bureaucratic feeling of, look, we recognize that this risk is out there for misinformation and disinformation, but we don't agree to the scale at which this will be disruptive to our political system. There is sort of the original sin, which is not the lack of acknowledgement that this, in fact, will be highly disruptive to the political system if we don't do anything to counteract it.
Tom said there had been, up until that point, a kind of naive and optimistic mindset around social media. Basically, it was the positive feeling that Silicon Valley marketed the platforms with.
Then there's the realistic side of things, the pessimistic side, or sort of the dark side, which is actually these tools that are built for good, for connecting people, can be used for evil, and they can be used for evil at scale. There have always been bad actors that use technology to do things, but never weaponized to the effect and to the scale that the Russians were able to do in 2016. We took our eye off the ball. We didn't actually recognize that it could be truly effective at disrupting the flow of accurate and free information. We made a mistake. We made a very big mistake.
But what was happening rapidly. The volumes and divisiveness of information being thrown at a U.S. election seemed to defy description. As we've shown over the series so far, the St. Petersburg trolls, RT, and the networks of alternative media websites, the hacks conducted by Russian intelligence and leaked through DC Leaks, Guccifer 2.0, and WikiLeaks, all of it was converging. The chaos gave cover for American disorder. Breitbart News, run by Steve Bannon, Cambridge Analytica, on whose board he sat, the alt-right and their fanboyism with Russia, all of it everywhere at once. And being very much a phenomenon enabled by the internet, there was no single force in charge, not on the US side and not among the Russians either. The Russians, however, did have a word for this, bardak.
Bardak is a Turkish word. In Turkish means house that needs repair. But in Russian, it was appropriated by the language with the meaning of a complete disorder, like that everything falls apart and it doesn't have to be about a particular place or space. It could be bardak in your brain. So your mind is in a full disorder.
This is Vasily Gatov, the Russian media academic we heard from before.
The whole thing was kind of designed by people whom we in Russia call political technologists. So the people who, well, normally do nasty part of the political campaigns during the elections. So attacking the opponents and collecting compromising material on the opponents and releasing them.
The internet made so much of the American political process accessible to the outside world, including to those who were intent on disrupting it. And what was the impact of violating the public's ability to know what was going on in their own election? Well, the effect was to blow a space wide open in the collective imagination of the public. Now, in the public imagination, anything was possible. Into this void would rush a torrent of conspiracy theories. The structure of the internet helped. In conspiracy theories, everything is connected. So too on the internet. Factoring into the chaos was what was happening on the ground in the U.S. too.
My name is Dmitry Valiev. I am a head of the Russian diaspora organization called Russian America for Democracy in Russia.
Dmitry's organization believes in a democratic Russia, and it coordinates with like-minded members of the Russian diaspora for this goal. Being a Russian abroad, Dmitry is aware of other diaspora organizations, ones with very different goals.
The organizations like this, compatriot organizations, they exist in many countries. There are dozens of them across the globe.
As a Russian living in the U.S., Valuev was aware of what those compatriot groups were doing in 2016.
So the organization I'm talking about, the compatriot organization, its abbreviation in Russian is KSORS. The full name is basically can be translated as a compatriot organization of Russian abroad. The organization is overseen by Rossotrudnichestvo, which is a government agency in Russia whose primary focus is the affairs of Russians abroad.
KSORS was designed to promote Russia's rich and varied culture and to keep it alive for Russians who emigrated abroad. But, like with many organizations answerable to Moscow, things changed. Even before 2016, members of these compatriot groups hosted events aimed at building up Russia's image. But in the election year, they pivoted towards the campaign.
most of the trolls pretended to be local American citizens or American residents. I would say that different methods and different mechanisms were employed to extend the Kremlin's influence here in the States and in the West.
They ran their own efforts on social media, too.
Not just the direct activity of pro-Kremlin organizations in the States through different events, public events, or online activity, but also through exclusively online mechanisms that someone can create dozens of accounts and spread messages in a social media that would influence the public opinion. And key people in that organization, the administrators of the group, a Facebook group, related to protesting in the United States right ahead of the election, that would support one of the sides of the election cycle. Facebook trolls would go to different groups, share different messages, and again, not just against one candidate, but in support of other candidates, again, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and so on, trying to achieve some sort of clashing between different groups. That's the main goal. It's not just to undermine one or support the other candidate, but to create some sort of a chaos, an image of that, you know, everybody is against everybody.
The goal from this Russian compatriot group was to inject disorder into the American political scene.
And that was a clear indication how they think and how they operate. It doesn't really matter for them. They don't have any ideology, but they support whatever can destabilize the situation.
As expat Russians pretended to be Americans at rallies in the U.S., in another effort, people at the St. Petersburg Troll Factory, disguising themselves, reached out to Americans via social media. They invited them to take part in real rallies that they were organizing in the U.S. from Russia.
I'm here today because I'm a Christian Houstonian, and I really believe that what is happening across the street does not really truly represent Texas. We live in a country where we have freedom of religion, freedom, and that includes people who are Muslim.
Some rallies weren't specifically about the election, but about issues likely to divide people: race, religion, history. And like the bots and the mass trolling driven from abroad, much of their work was done early in the election cycle, before 2016 began. Here's a line on the rallies from a U.S. government report.
The earliest evidence of a rally was a Confederate rally in November 2015. The IRA continued to organize rallies even after the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The attendance at rallies varied. The reach and success of these rallies was closely monitored.
The effect was to add to the chaos on the ground at the local level in the U.S. Most famously, an anti-Muslim rally in Houston was organized, as was a counter-rally, both remotely, from Russia.
Those protesting it had been prompted by a Facebook group called Heart of Texas. Anti-Islamic propaganda posted by the Heart of Texas actually originated in the heart of Russia, a so-called troll factory called the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg.
Some of the rallies attracted a handful of participants, some thousands. Some Americans were paid to organize the rallies to promote or disparage candidates. Constant experimentation, constant effort. Whether these rallies factored directly into the chaos surrounding Trump's appearances is unclear.
Has campaign violence gone viral? Those are the big questions this week after the ugliest 2 days of a dangerously angry White House race. Dayton, Saturday afternoon. Trump startled when a protester storms the stage. Police use pepper spray outside a Trump rally. Arrest.
It's still not clear who orchestrated the violence. Was it Trump's people? Were compatriot groups involved? Were these tactics of Russian political technologists, these mini spectacles that would gobble up the attention of the local media? Whatever the case, the pattern of violence and spectacle had a strategic effect. While social media was flooded with disinformation, the real media was confronted with spectacle everywhere. And the compatriot groups added to the spectacle.
They disseminated information. They conducted public events at traditional gathering locations like Times Square or the UN building in New York, and so on. They disseminated different leaflets. What they did in New York, they hired a small aircraft, small plane, and flew a huge ribbon of what's called the Georgian ribbon, which became a symbol of pro-Kremlin, pro-Moscow guerrilla groups in eastern Ukraine. Those visual things, those visual events that you can capture, you can photograph, you can record, and you can then disseminate to demonstrate that, you know, we are here, this is our presence, this is our message. That's something that we know for a fact that compatriot organizations related to the Russian government actually did here in the States.
Part of the confusion arises from the fact that the Kremlin stands for no greater political position than opposition to the West.
The West is the force that confronts Putin. The West is powerful enough, so again, the big picture for Putin is certainly to undermine the West, not just Europe, not just the United States, but the kind of collective West. And he would do everything possible to achieve that. If he needs to support one candidate in one country and candidate with the opposite values, with the opposite platform, he would do that.
Order was fractured around the campaign, and it didn't take much to see a Russian dimension. For example, not only were Russian compatriot groups in the U.S. taking part, but back in Moscow, Russian ideologue Alexander Dugin was all in for Trump and posting videos in English. And Dugin had numerous people-to-people contacts with extremists in the West.
I really like Donald Trump, but I detest the crazy warmongering neoconservatives, sodom Mitt Rubio and hypocrite pseudo-Christian Cruz. I don't like this stuff at all. Donald Trump is the most right-wing candidate of the Republican Party, but not like the insane, disabled McCain or the ex-Trotskyist neoconservatives obsessed with the idea of world dominance.
These disparate groups acted seemingly in concert. The compatriots, the troll factory, Alexander Dugin. Who was urging these disparate figures to weigh in for Trump? There were other ways to hijack attention. On the 6th of October, 2016, a huge banner of Vladimir Putin in front of a Russian flag with the word peacemaker below his face was unfurled on New York's Manhattan Bridge.
The banner in New York, it's never been discovered who did that. But we see a similar pattern even with the compatriot organizations related to the another big series of events that they organized.
Attacking a country with an open internet gave visibility into just how effective such disruption was. All the chaos, all the interference, all the bardock. The spectacle of Donald Trump at the street level competed with the spectacle found online. Just like how Russia conjured a dueling reality over Ukraine 2 years before. In the process, the media was held hostage to a stream of events beyond its ability to effectively scrutinize. It was like waves crashing over you, preventing you from catching your breath. Before the public could get to the bottom of one violent incident, another incident occurred. Anything approaching a shared understanding of the event was obliterated. Outlandish notions began to compete with reality. Conspiracy theories mapped easily onto social media. Here is audio of Hillary Clinton having a coughing fit during the campaign.
I've been talking so every time I think about Trump, I get allergic.
The conspiracy theories about her health seeped over from social media to media. After all, everyone was talking about it.
Let's take a look at that video that we just got in a second ago of Hillary Clinton getting in to her vehicle and seeming to have some trouble standing as she gets into the vehicle.
Once the ideas caught on, it became what's known as a trending term. And if it was a trending term, it was a pretty sure bet for the media.
She's had two incidents that have occurred, medical incidents. One, she coughed, and the other, she overheated. Look, she's actually provided more records and more information than Donald Trump has. Does she need to provide more? That is a legitimate question to ask.
When Clinton, suffering from a cold and dehydration, stumbled after leaving a 9/11 commemoration ceremony, the trolls went wild. Participating in what had become a gamified version of an election, some claimed her stumble was a result of their magical thinking and trolling. Did they really believe this? Did it matter? On the internet, fully untrue ideas could defeat real-world facts. The trolls knew this. The game was to get the media to follow. Election day neared, the wheel of spectacle turned and turned again. The public was fired up to a state of agitation. Many didn't quite know what to believe. Enter WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks came to global prominence promising to impose transparency on secretive governments. One of its most famous acts was publishing a classified U.S. military video of an army helicopter gunning down what turned out to be civilians on a Baghdad street. At the time of the 2016 U.S. election, WikiLeaks leader Julian Assange was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. In October, a full month out from Election Day, damning audio of Donald Trump bragging in a demeaning way about his exploits with women emerged.
I took off her and I moved on her like a bitch.
His comments had been picked up by the television show Access Hollywood.
And all of a sudden I see her, she's now got the big phony tits and everything. She's totally changed her looks. I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy. I can do anything.
Within minutes, WikiLeaks began publishing the emails of John Podesta, the chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign. The same emails hacked by Russian hacking group Fancy Bear. Assange would later deny Russia was the source of these emails. Nevertheless, WikiLeaks social media channels posted links to the emails, published with a flurry of recurring hashtags.
Hashtag DNC leak. Hashtag Hillary Clinton. Hashtag Podesta emails. Hashtag never Hillary. Hashtag drain the swamp. Hashtag spirit cooking.
The social media accounts of alternative media news sites, like the ones mentioned in episode 1, surged with the same hashtags. To cast your eye down the Twitter feed, the tags were like snow gathered in the corners of windows during a blizzard. There seemed to be a level of automation, the real and the fake all blended together, silently, totally, everywhere. There was an important twist here. The links to the database of 50,000 emails included screenshotted highlights. But those posts also contained screen grabs of images and terms related to elaborate conspiracy theories. WikiLeaks, the radical transparency organization known for exposing hidden truths, now posted material on social media claiming something called spirit cooking was going on behind the scenes at the Democratic Party. One tweet read,
"The Podesta spirit cooking dinner, it's not what you think. It's blood, sperm, and breast milk, but mostly blood."
The tweet featured a picture of what looked like words painted in blood on a wall. But the blood was actually paint. The satanic ritual was actually performance art. The alternate reality was being pushed hard on social media.
Weird occult dinner parties where blood, semen, and breast milk are used in ritualistic ceremonies. No, this isn't a fake news story. It's absolutely real. In an email dated June 28, 2015, performance artist Maria Abramovich wrote to Podesta's brother Tony and said, "I'm so looking forward."
They were real emails, but they were wildly, yet creatively, miscontextualized. The posts also suggested Podesta was involved in a child abuse scheme at a pizza shop. Given WikiLeaks' past role as an exposer of government secrets, its shift to seeding conspiracy theory about government would have a supercharged effect.
Megan, as many controversies do these days, it began with a tweet. On October 30th, days after the FBI announced they'd be reopening an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, the rumor spread, inspiring some newfound internet sleuths to start digging around in John Podesta's hacked emails, searching for proof and location of the so-called sex ring.
Conspiracy theory was no longer on the fringes, but was going mainstream. And it was being force-fed to an already agitated, suggestible public via social media, at scale. All that was needed is a concerted effort to link pizza with a wildly unrelated and damning topic.
For example, hot dog is code for boy. Pizza is code for girl. Cheese is code for little girl. Pasta is code for little boy. Ice cream is code for male prostitute. Why was Podesta using these words in a way to suggest code speak in these emails so often?
Enough people on the internet accepted the idea that cheese pizza was child porn, the human imagination, with a surge of social media posting, took over from there. Olga Boychuk, the Ukrainian academic we heard from earlier, the one who first watched Russia meddle in eastern Ukraine.
Yes, and sowing distrust in the media system, in the public institutions, it is heavily associated with conspiratorial thinking, because conspiratorial thinking emerges in contexts that are admittedly complex, where there's no easy solutions. So these narratives where one convinces themselves that the government is lying and the media is lying and everything, in fact, has a much simpler explanation, they become very attractive.
I watched in dismay as these ideas blossomed online. They were everywhere. The effect of the 50,000 leaked emails spread far and wide on social media was, for some, overwhelming.
If we don't have trust in public institutions, if we believe that the media is lying to us, right, there it becomes very easy to believe some of those outrageous claims.
For many people, this lurid storyline competed for attention with the news of the election. But it was more dramatic, more compelling, and it tapped into a clearer sense of good versus evil. Russian intelligence first hacked the Democrats' emails, as they had also hacked the Republican National Committee's emails in 2016, but never released that material. As the presidential campaign became more chaotic, the Russian effort moved from discrediting democracy and denigrating Hillary Clinton to, with the blessing of Vladimir Putin, supporting Donald Trump's improbable campaign. Inasmuch as the Kremlin was behind this, hacking emails, helping amp them on social media, the Kremlin's allies effectively pole-vaulted right over any geographical or cultural defense the U.S. might have enjoyed. Phil, who we heard from in earlier episodes, who first stumbled into the Russian disinformation when he was nation-building in Afghanistan, had been in touch with his old friends.
I called my colleagues who I work with in Afghanistan. We hurriedly set up a website to publish the list of sites that pushed Kremlin conspiracy. We named ourselves Prop War Not.
Prop War Not was written up in the media, then savaged by some. Brute force conspiracism flooded across the social media feeds of Americans, reshaping the campaign. The spectacle unfolded on social media, drawing in more people, in the process altering what reality they saw through the filter of their feed. The conspiracism wasn't just limited to social media. In the summer of 2016, a 27-year-old Democratic National Committee employee named Seth Rich had been shot in the streets of Washington, D.C. one night as he came home from a bar. This news was ingested into the massive conspiracy aimed at the campaign. This is Julian Assange on a Dutch news program.
As a 27-year-old, I works for the DNC. He was shot in the back, murdered just 2 weeks ago for unknown reasons as he was walking down the street in Washington.
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that our sources take risks.
But it's quite something to suggest a murder. That's basically what you're doing.
Well, that others have suggested that. We are investigating to understand what happened in that situation with Seth Rich.
WikiLeaks offered a $20,000 reward for information on Rich's murder. If you followed the logic of the conspiracy theories corkscrewing through the political debate, you would never come back to a shared reality. Before the year was out, an armed man would drive from North Carolina to a Washington, D.C. pizza place named in the Podesta emails, shooting up the restaurant. He said he was there to save the children. The QAnon conspiracy theory was born in the Pizzagate conspiracy theory.
After police arrived, Welch surrendered peacefully, saying that he was trying to rescue the children he was sure were hidden inside.
No longer about a political choice, the presidential vote became a referendum on competing realities. It became, like so much in the realm of social media, a binary issue. Unlike past elections, there was no middle ground. Clinton was portrayed as a nefarious insider, Trump as a destructive disruptor, and lurid conspiracies explained everything else. Tom Cochran from the State Department.
When truth becomes something that you can have your own truths, then you don't have the ability to have an asymmetrical landscape of information. And when you have an information landscape that is asymmetrical, then when you start questioning what is the truth, it becomes a huge problem. It was a period of time where we were still in the naive part of social media being a force for good, purely a force for good, connecting people, and things that you see online were generally factual and truthful. We now have a higher degree of skepticism, I think, as a general public, to question, at least partially, what we see online.
And it was also new. The impact of this brute force assault on the fabric of reality around a presidential election stunned, and I'd say even scarred, people.
The Pandora's box has been opened, and this is a tool, again, a force for good to galvanize people around political causes, but it also opens us up to serious risk of misinformation and disinformation.
But the shock from the technology was so great, it would actually reorder the political world. It would take some time to see.
In that regard, I think 2016 was that kind of moment, which was, oh, this actually can be used for evil purposes, and we need to figure out as a society, as a global society, not just a single small community, but a global society of 8 billion people, how do we use this and make sure that it remains a net positive for humanity?
The trauma of 2016 stays with us, continues to shape democracy's politics. The awareness of the tool's power was there, but it was the imagination of how dramatically they could be used and scaled up that governments would struggle with. The gap opened between what could be socially engineered on the internet and what could be effectively regulated and defended against. Everyone was plunged into this digital reality. The networks of social media were now arguably more influential than the conventional media itself. Would all that we know, the laws, the customs, the unspoken rules of democracy, would it hold? Watching it now, the governments were so misaligned, the public so unprepared, the democratic system so exposed, it was like a dark, shining moment passing over us and all we thought we knew about democracy, about politics, about who we were. Election day neared. In Moscow, Ambassador Tesh watched Russian officials seemingly rally behind Trump.
I would say to a couple of professional contacts and amongst sort of my Russian friends, are you really sure that this is going to be as good as you think? I just, from a purely, I guess, pragmatic, bureaucratic point of view, I remember saying to a couple of them, look, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, you would have had your talking points and your briefing papers all worked out because you would be dealing with a known entity there with probably more consistency and coherence in the trajectory of American foreign policy. Yet with Donald Trump, you are electing a maverick from the foreign policy point of view to the highest office, the most powerful office, certainly in the United States and in the world, and the signals that he had been sending during the campaign didn't give grounds to believe that there would be stability, coherence, and predictability.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated.
And then Trump won. Riding a wave of online interference, he won.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign. I mean, she fought very hard.
And my last day was actually the day after the election, the Clinton-Trump election. And it had been planned that way. I was on my way out to private sector to do something different, but I had thought that it would be a departure, a victorious departure, handing the keys and handing the baton off to the Clinton, incoming Clinton team.
And instead, what did it feel like on that day when you left?
It felt like I was walking into a building that was in the middle of a funeral. It felt like a gut punch. It felt like everyone, I think similar to most of the world, was shocked and surprised about the outcome of the election. I remember sitting in the debrief room where they have to do sort of the perfunctory classified debriefing of these are the things you can and can't say as you depart and go on your merry way in the professional world.
I know how disappointed you feel because I feel it too. And so do tens of millions of Americans who invested their hopes and dreams in this effort.
But in the background, of course, there's a TV, and the TV is showing Clinton giving her concession speech. A very surreal moment, especially that 24 hours prior to that, we were preparing for the inevitable victory that we thought was coming.
Inclusive and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought.
Next time on Dark Shining Moment, the election is over, but the public's suspicion goes into overdrive. Trump's foes saw in him a Russian agent. His supporters saw a different conspiracy altogether. Dark Shining Moment is a Ranierian co-production, reported and written by me, Chris Sapone. Sound design by Martin Peralta. Executive producer, Greg Mueller. Consulting producer, Richard Baker. And managing producer, Nick Randall.